This meeting is now being recorded.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the May 18th meeting of the Trial Court Budget Advisory Committee. We are meeting in San Francisco today. It is an open meeting, and our meeting is being broadcast, so I would ask that when you do address an issue on our agenda today, if you could state your name for the record, if you would. We do have a rather heavy agenda today, which is why we're meeting until 4 o'clock. I apologize for that. We also have had complications with folks getting here today, either via BART or airplane, so some of our folks will trickle in, I believe, but we do have a quorum to go forward. We may jump around on the agenda a little bit to make sure that we have optimal attendance at issues that we need to take action on that we haven't seen on our agenda before. Before we go further, I am going to take roll. It is in alphabetical order, so I don't mean to offend any of our judges in the room, but I'm going to call it that way. Judge Boris, I know, is on his way. Alan Carlson?
Here.
Cherry Carter is on her way. Jake Chatters?
Here.
Judge Conklin?
Here.
Judge Cope?
Here.
Judge DeSantos?
Here.
Rick Feldstein?
Here.
Rebecca Fleming? Kimberly Flenner?
Here.
Judge Gall? One second. Judge Good is on his way. Jose Guillen?
Here.
Judge Harmon?
Here.
Judge Holland? Judge Johnson? Judge Kuehl? I believe Judge Kuehl will be calling in at some point. Sean Landry?
Here.
Judge Lee?
Here.
Judge Maragonda?
Here.
Stephen Nash is on his way. Debbie Norrie?
Here.
Mike Roddy?
Here.
Judge Slough?
Present.
Judge Smith is on her way. Mary Beth Todd?
Here.
Kim Turner?
Here.
Chris Volkers is on her way. David Yamasaki?
Here.
Jody Patel? Kurt Soderlund? Zlatko Theodorovich?
Here.
And we also are supported by Judicial Council staff today, Lucy Fogarty, Colin Simpson, Bob Fleshman, and Stephen Chang. Is there anyone else who's...
Patrick Ballard.
And Patrick Ballard and Vicki Musney are here. All right. And Judge Johnson is here. Thank you for being here. The first item on our agenda is approval of the minutes for our March 23rd and April 13th meetings. The April 13th meeting was in action by email. Is there a motion to approve the minutes?
Make the motion.
That was Sean Landry.
Second.
That was Kim Turner. Any discussion about the minutes? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Minutes are approved.
Corey, are you on the line? This is Zlatko for our first item on the Governor's May Revision Budget Update. Yeah. If not, I can certainly take this issue.
Thank you.
So hopefully most, if not all of you, are able to join the phone calls that we had on Friday regarding an update to the May revision, in the May revision offered by the governor on Thursday. Was there anybody who was not able to make that call? Judge Harmon, Judge Miragon. Okay, so several of you. That's fine. So, yes, the May revision was updated. It was provided on Thursday per statute. The governor is required to provide no later than May 14th of every year an update based on revenues, caseloads, population changes that affect the budget. And it basically gives the legislature 1 month from their statutory deadline of June 15th to pass the budget. So theory the legislature gets this in order to be able to deliberate the final budget. The good news is that the economy is still purring away for the state of California, and the state projects $6.7 billion of additional revenues to the system. Unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on where you are, a vast majority of that funding is going to kindergarten through 12 education per the Proposition 98 funding formulas. But the governor did identify some other areas that were of a priority for him and in his budget update. In particular, like I said, $5.5 billion going to education and community colleges, $600 million going into the Rainy Day Fund, so an investment there to manage the future budget issues, a $380 million California Earned Income Tax Credit to address and help the lowest income earners in the state, as part of an issue to help the UCs pay down its unfunded pension liabilities, providing them funds to hold tuition flat, and also there are increases in health in an area for, as they said, safety net services for currently undocumented immigrants as it relates to the president's executive order actions regarding undocumented immigrants. And also there's still issues with local funding for realignment. So the governor's meeting those priorities. But with respect to the branch, there were really two issues that were reflected in the May revision. As you know, we've had this ongoing issue with our softness in our trial court trust fund revenues. This time last year, we unfortunately were only provided a portion of the revenue shortfall that we had identified for the administration. This year, the governor's budget included $19.8 million to provide us revenue stability for the TCTF. Staff have projected a further decline for 15-16 and to the level of $15.5 million. So luckily and thankfully, the administration saw fit to provide us those funds. So outside of what was occurred last year, the $22.7 million that was not provided, that means we have a shortfall, and that's a topic of discussion today. The further decline in revenues to the TCTF are being backfilled with general fund resources, so there will be no further impact on trial court allocations. But that means that then over the past two fiscal years, general fund revenues of $66 million will have been provided just to maintain a level. And as we know, that wasn't sufficient because we needed almost $90 million to stay even with our revenue declines over the last several years. So we unfortunately still have to deal with the 22.7 that was carried forward, but it's not getting worse from an overall allocation standpoint because the administration is reflecting the 15.5. Are there any questions about the revenue issues? I want to make sure you understand we see civil filings and the revenues associated with them declining. We have a court operations assessment, which is on the criminal side also declining. Those are our major drivers of declining revenues. But any questions before we go on? And just know that we've discussed with the Department of Finance this overall issue of revenues because the next topic is also going to be related to this overall system of revenues, the civil criminal penalties, civil fines, criminal penalties, the fact that how our branch is funded, the fact that we're on this downward slope of trial court trust fund revenues, and how should we be funded. And obviously that has implications for other areas that rely on criminal fines and penalties that now the amnesty program that the administration is proposing to update relate to. As you know, we have our own problems with our revenues declining. Well, there's been declines in revenues in other areas of the state operations that rely on the criminal activity and the fines and penalties that come with it. And the administration's proposed an update. We were thinking maybe they might undo the amnesty proposal given the revenues, and we were looking forward to something a little more positive in terms of the changes. But unfortunately, the changes to the amnesty program have actually made it more burdensome upon the trial courts and the counties to manage. The some of the, as I said on the phone calls on Friday, some of the lowlights are, where in the past we had full cost recovery authority, that now the administration is proposing to cap our cost recovery at $50 per individual that participates in the amnesty program. In the past, the total owed amount was what was subject to being halved as part of amnesty. Now what they're doing is taking any of the civil assessment revenue that's part of that, any civil assessments that are part of the total, removing them, and then what is the remainder is then subject to being halved as part of the amnesty. So they've removed any of the civil assessment revenue that we would have gotten from the amnesty program from the program. They've established and made folks eligible for payment programs, but as a backstop to the payments, if folks drop off the payment plans, they're requiring counties and trial courts to gather information necessary to engage in a wage garnishment process through Franchise Tax Board, which was not part of the last proposal. And so this is a major workload change for those that are administering the amnesty program. We will see implementation will be October 1st of 15 and run for 18 months. DMV will now have a role in terms of a payment being made to DMV to reinstate licenses so that their costs are covered. There's also going to be a requirement that inserts be put into all vehicle registrations and a website in order to help advertise. But for some reason, they felt that the Judicial Council budget should those costs. So, again, in spite of $6.7 billion asking the branch to cover costs of administering this program to benefit the Peace Officers Training Fund and the Corrections Training Fund, that's clearly going to be an issue for us as we go forward. There'll be a report that will be required to be submitted, so that means that you'll all be having to collect lots of data, and you will be required to report that to us, and we'll have to submit that report to the legislature in 2017. We had already been asking Mary Beth and Rick to provide us input that we could pass on to the Legislative Analyst Office. They were writing their – we haven't seen any products yet, but they were providing their – they're supposed to provide their commentary at some point today, and they were working on it over the weekend. So hopefully we are able to mobilize quickly enough to get some feedback, helpful feedback, to the Legislative Analyst's Office on Friday so that they could bring in that as part of their analysis. So we have some work to do, obviously. In terms of next steps, the budget – do we want to talk about amnesty at all? I know I'm in Mary Beth's. She probably said more than she wants to, but it's or Rick, I know it's just something where we've been managing. Just so you know, I mean, we tried through this spring to work with the Department of Finance on this. We brought Mary Beth and Rick and others on the informal collections group with Department of Finance on phone calls, and we provided them information to try and get them to understand the burden of an amnesty program, both from an administrative standpoint and overall policy perspective on now the frequency of was it 4 years ago that we had an amnesty program, three and a half, and prior to that was 17 years, and so kind of having another amnesty quickly here sort of undermines the intent of the system. Judge Harmon, you had a question?
Yeah, has there been some discussion about how we send ours to collections, how you're supposed to get those back to amnesty?
That's been a question that we've posed to them, and how that works.
And I have been talking with Susan Matherly about that. She sent me some information this morning. She talked to her collections vendor, and it's something that needs to be worked out. There are a lot of moving parts. I think one of the big things we're trying to figure out, and if anybody's out in front of this and can share their information, please do, and that's trying to get a sense of what that loss in civil assessment, if you think you're going to have that loss, what, you know, trying to get a sense of, is it substantial, is it not substantial? So if anybody's running any numbers with respect to, you know, your normal collections and what percentage of your normal collections would fall within those cases that would qualify for amnesty, and take a look at, you know, what you would have reasonably expected to collect in civil assessments, and we're trying to get our arms around that to be able to determine, you know, for many of us, either our courts or our counties are very reliant on that revenue, and we want to try to get a sense of whether that's going to be significant and what kind of impact that will have. So if anybody's out in front on that issue and wants to let Rick, Bob Fleshman, or I know, or Zlotko, please send us an email. We'd love to hear from you.
Mm-hmm. Very much so. It's Rick.
Yeah, the only thing I would add to that is that there is a fee that's paid by people participating in the amnesty program. I guess it's proposed to be up to $50 at this point to pay for the cost of the program. And looking at what happened to the last amnesty program and what was expended of court resources and reimbursed, that $50 may not cover the full expense, meaning it's going to come out of our pocket.
Right.
And so
Rick,
we may also want to be
– the math was on the total value of cost was $2.8 million, and I think we had 42,000 if I'm remembering. But it came out to be about $68 per successful transaction. So
right.
You can see there's a gap and –
Yeah, if that holds true, we would only get about two-thirds of our cost covered.
Yeah, which is
approximately.
With more work.
More work.
As compared to the prior.
So we may want to be thinking about what is the impact of having to draw resources from other areas of court operations to cover those costs.
Right, and then because of the payment plan, then the recovery would then be spread out over the total. So you wouldn't, so you'd have to have invest upfront resources, and you wouldn't get the recovery until, you know, some time in pieces over the life of the payment plan, which also is a problem.
Right. So I think one of our goals would be to try to get that piece changed to allowing us to distribute our costs under, you know, run it through our enhanced collections program. It's already in place. I think that I'm hoping that would be a persuasive argument.
As are we. Okay, thank you. In terms of next steps, I think this is for me and my 17 years of working on the budget. I've never had the May revision come out on a Thursday, and budget hearings are starting already tomorrow. And so the Senate and the Assembly are having budget hearings, and fortunately they're having them about the same time. And so we will be having to manage this in both houses quickly. And we're not sure why they're moving so quickly in terms of, you know, the hearings, because they usually give themselves a week to talk about things, to digest things. So, but we are moving quickly to sort of get all the input to folks. We don't have agendas. We don't know what their items that they'll be taking up. I mean, we suspect that since the budget did not include anything for dependency council, and it's been a topic of great interest in the legislature, that it's likely that might be where the legislature takes up that issue, rather than since the administration didn't provide any resources in their May revision. So we're hopeful that there might be something there, and any other additional resources might be coming through the process. Will be in the legislative area. Yes, Alan.
The governor's budget assumed the sunset on the fees would be lifted.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't heard anything at all about that, so I'm assuming that's happening.
They've been heard in both houses, the trailer bill. The only discussion has been whether or not the sunsets are eliminated or merely extended. So I think there might be probably some sensitivity to a permanent elimination, and they might just look to extend the sunsets 3 to 5 years, something like that. The budget really didn't make any other changes. I think we'd let folks know what happened in April in terms of the land WAN, that they provided that. They did a little bit of an update to their 5%. There was a little technical error there. We did do the updates to the benefits. That was good. Budget from the administration continues the $20 million IMF retention. So, like I said, all those major components from the governor's January proposal, some minor changes in April, and now these two issues in May are really sort of where we're at. So we're kind of holding on to the structure that was proposed in the governor's budget. Revenue declines are being addressed. That's good. But now we have this amnesty proposal that we have to manage. Yes, Judge Lau.
So we just learned late Friday night of the hearings being on Tuesday, and just today learned the actual designated times for them. So if anybody, I know it's very late notice, but anyone who can contact your local representatives to support the issues that are of importance to us all, please do so. If you can join Mary Beth, Rick, and myself tomorrow, I know it's very, very late notice, but please also you'd be very warmly welcomed to join us. I don't know that there will actually be any testimony. It just kind of sounds like it's going to be a Me Too kind of thing because we don't even know what the agenda is yet.
Tomorrow in the Senate, it's at 10 o'clock in room 113. And then at 11 o'clock, the assembly starts in room 437. So those are stacked on top of each other. And it's supposed to be all departments, so it could be a scattershot approach, but we'll do our best to represent and get on the record as far as the amnesty proposals and anything else that's to the benefit of the branch. I think did we just see Kurt? Did you?
Any other questions for Zlatko regarding the May revise?
All right. Well, we'll let you know as we go along with email updates as major things occur.
Thank you. The next item on our agenda, item two, is children's waiting room distribution. This has been on our agenda before, but we've run out of time and we've deferred it, so we've put it at the top of the list. And since Judge Good is battling traffic, Kimberly Flinner has agreed to present this for us. Thank you.
Thanks, Judge. And as Judge Earl indicated, this has been before this committee in the past. The original recommendation was adopted by the council in June of last year, but we were asked specifically, this subcommittee was asked to look at those courts where the program, the children's waiting room program, is either ceased or has never occurred. So we came before this committee in January with the recommendation, and at that time we're asked to revisit and get a legal opinion on the return of those funds as we had recommended in the policy. So we did that, and that's what attachment 2D2 is. So if we can kind of walk through that. And again, I'll remind you that the monies that are held and restricted locally are only restricted locally. For these courts that have this fund balance in children's waiting room, if they are not utilizing and those funds are returned to the trial court trust fund, they are unrestricted and available for allocation. So again, that's why we were looking at the issue. Items A and B that were formerly adopted by the council did not change. We made some clarifying points on item C, more specific language with regard to timing, and that's for programs or courts, rather, that have ceased operating those children's waiting rooms. The item that, again, I said we were asked to revisit was specific to D and E, so I'll walk through those with you. Item 2D2, Section D. So
what page of our materials is that on?
15.
42 is the revised version. If you're on 16, it's just the two sections where it's different. So you can follow along 16, and I'll point those two arrows out. It's just a regard to one date said August should say October, one date said July should have said January. So that's the only difference on 2D2. So 2D, Section D, again, I'll remind you that the committee strongly encouraged courts to police themselves. That was one of the primary goals of this. So that's the first bullet. Courts shall monitor the CWR distribution amount per filing to ensure it's adequate to meet the needs of the court without accumulating an amount in excess of the cap described below. That item further talks about the cap. So effective this coming fiscal year, this is when this will apply. Any courts who balance exceeds that cap at the end of fiscal year 15-16 will be expected to return the amount of money in excess of that cap beginning in fiscal year 16-17. Courts that have extenuating circumstances can certainly submit an application forward requesting that they be able to exceed that cap amount, and that has to be done within 60 days of the fiscal year end. Courts that do not submit any application or request for extenuating circumstances shall return the monies in excess of that cap in their August distribution. What came up in question in January was, how can we do that? The group talked about the ability to write a check, which added workload to both the local court as well as Judicial Council Finance. So the agreement was that it would be held from your distribution, and we wanted to ensure that that was allowable. So basically it is an accounting entry, and that's what we were told. There would be communication between the court and the finance office, so no surprises, but any court in excess who would be returning monies would work with Judicial Council Finance to make that happen, and it would happen during the roughly August distribution. Any questions on Section D? Those were the areas from the January meeting that we were asked to revisit. Okay. Section E, that pertains to just a few courts who received a distribution since January 2006 but have never operated a children's waiting room during that time period. So they are being asked to submit an application no later than September of this year, September 2015. Otherwise, their distribution will be stopped January 1, 2016. For courts that are required to return their remaining fund balance, the return will occur on October trial court distribution. If there's a dispute in those cases, again, that will come back before the Budget Advisory Committee and the Judicial Council if the two parties do not come to a resolution within 90 days of the cessation date. That's the recommendation.
And I'm sorry, what, the October of
2015, I'm sorry, for those specific courts, yes, 2015.
Those courts that have the balance that have never used it have to return it this year.
Correct.
Do we need to clarify that in the recommendation just so there's no confusion about 15 over 16?
We can do that with that item because that was a very specific group. The other ones we were trying to leave out the fiscal year because this policy would go forward, but yes, I would accept that.
So are we at bullet two on page 42 under E?
Yes.
So will occur on the October trial court distribution beginning in October of 2016?
This one would be very specific to, it would say for courts that are required to return all of their remaining CWR fund balance to the TCTF, the return will occur on the October 2015 trial court distribution.
Okay. Judge Slaw, did you have a question?
So I have two questions, and they are actually questions that Sherry Carter asked me to ask in case she couldn't get here in time. The first, and it's related to subsection C, is the first one, and the second one is E. The first question is, why allow a court to apply to keep money in reserve if it permanently closes its children's playroom, which is the question regarding subsection C? And the second question is, why allow a court to keep funds if it never operated a children's playroom, and that is E.
So this item did come up, and there were some circumstances just within the subcommittee that we were made aware of, and that would be courts that are under new construction now, have a plan to open but have had issues, and I know we have courts out there. We have one outstanding application right now for review from Merced, and that would be in that similar situation. So if they've received money, haven't yet opened it, they'd make application, again, not keeping the entire balance, but only up to that cap amount.
Kim Turner, and I'm sorry, Judge Slaw, did that answer your questions?
Sorry, I think it did one, but I don't know that it did the second one, which is actually, it may have answered both of them,
perfect.
Unless there's a different scenario that
same
you can anticipate
scenario.
For both. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. I see Tim Turner and then Chris Volkers.
So I guess I'm a little confused about, so if we have a court that has either never opened a children's waiting room and a new construction is, underway, how will we determine what that cap amount is? Because the cap appears to be related to the last 3 years of costs for operating the children's waiting room if you do not have any such costs. Am I missing something here?
It's not the cost. It's the distribution. The cap is the last 3 years, the highest distribution.
Oh, okay.
So
okay.
They have been receiving it. They would, again, use their last 3 years. That's right, Stephen.
Okay.
Correct? Yes.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Chris? No, Jake. Laura answered it. Anyone else? Jake?
Just one clarification, sorry.
Okay.
So in D, mm-hmm. if we're making the change to add 2016,
correct.
Right. That means that whatever they currently have in fund balance at the end of this year for their children's waiting room, be returned in October, but they'll get one more distribution in January of 16, which would then be subject to the cap rules that already exist above, right? So most of all that they currently have would go back, but because of the rules on when the distributions can stop, this says they would get one more in January of 16, right?
Okay.
And then they'd have to give that back in the following October under the rules in D.
It's the cap at the end of the total fiscal year, though.
Right. So if they close, they don't ask to be extended.
Correct.
Right? So they would get one more distribution
yes.
in January
that
of
is correct.
16. But the balance they currently have would be reverted back in October of 15. And then that distribution they get in October of 16 would revert back October of 16 based on the rules in D.
Well, they would cease getting the distribution. That should have been the first one. Yeah. So if they're not receiving it, they cease getting it, and that
okay.
cessation would occur in January, so they wouldn't get it
they
in January.
Get it. The cessation
right.
would occur in January, but they wouldn't get
they
another
wouldn't
one
get,
like January
right.
or
no.
December 3rd. Okay,
they shouldn't,
ahead.
Correct, Stephen? Will you be able to do that? Okay.
Judge Earl?
Yes.
I'm just thinking perhaps that could be worded a little more clearly because I had the same impression that Jake did, that they were going to give back all their money and then get another distribution in January, which didn't make a lot of sense. So if there's a way to say that, particularly for these courts that have never operated a CWR, if they let us know by September 26th of 15 that, that they're not operating one, and then we reclaim the money in October of 15, they should not get another distribution in January of 16, we should just say that their distribution stop effective,
January.
Stop before the January 16 distribution, something like that, that will make it more clear. Because the way it reads right now, it sounds like they're getting money and then they have to give it back again the following fiscal year.
So for that specific to item E, correct, yours is you're speaking about the ones that have never operated.
Yes.
If they've never operated, that all is going to be cleaned up by October 2015. They will not get a distribution January 1 of 2016.
But it says, or have their distribution stopped on January 1st, 2016, which I think is just a little confusing.
Okay. So maybe it should say stopped by January 1st.
No later. Yes, yes, yes. It's just a no. little wordsmithing would make that clearer.
Or on or before.
So maybe not the or, I think, if that's speaking to it, because it can only happen twice a year. That was one of the issues that we
right.
found out subsequent. So January 1 or July 1. In this instance, they're all going to be January 1. So during
so
that time
say,
period.
Or have their distribution stopped prior to the January 1st, 2016 distribution.
Can't we just take out the words on January 1, 2016?
And have their distribution
stopped,
period.
And return to the TCETF any balance?
Yes. Is that agreeable, Kim? Do you think
yes.
that?
Yes. It is. It
Kimberly.
Is with me, certainly. But I know that was one of the questions we were asked to look at before is because the original language said as soon as is reasonable, and then it was identified that it can't occur. So those courts that notify us by September 26th, it stops, they're still going to get a distribution. Stephen, my understanding was they would continue to get it until that January 1, and then they no longer get it, correct? So clarifying language, are you fine with taking out the date just to indicate stopped? Does that still allow you to do what you need to do from your end?
That question's for you, Stephen.
I believe so.
I mean, the effect of this should be that if a court is not using it, it stops.
Correct.
I mean, we shouldn't have a lot of triggering dates other than the triggering date of letting us know when it's going to stop by. And then once that triggering date has occurred and the court has said, yes, we don't have a children's waiting room, we should reclaim the money in the October distribution, and that's the end of the story until such time as the court reapplies for money.
But the confusion that I hear is it sounds like, and maybe, Stephen, if you could come up to the microphone, that there are still distributions that will occur after
October, November, December.
And so
those
we
are
want
the ones that have to, again, we can't stop it because July is too soon. We're not going to be able to make that happen. So it would be the January 1 is the earliest, so that, yes, they're going to have to return those monies as well. They'll return up to the October 15th. The distribution will stop January 1, so anything that is received or allocated within the October, November, December timeframes would still need to be returned. That's correct, Stephen?
That's right. Ideally, courts would be able to let us know prior to July 1st, then we can stop it. The distribution's effective July 1st. Then we would have to deal with it. But if they don't let us know until afterwards, well, actually, it can be retroactive. Actually, we don't need to know. We can stop the distribution effective July 1st even because the monies don't actually come in until September. So, actually, this would still work. This will allow us to stop the distributions on July 1st, okay, even if they notified us in September.
So in that case, we can take Judge Harmon's recommended modification and strike the language that
– yes.
Okay. So that bullet would then indicate a CWR during that time period must either apply for a continued distribution by September 26, 2015, or – no, see, that's where the or is still problematic.
Well, they still need the or, right? Because they're going to apply or their distributions are going to be stopped.
Okay. So we – or have your distribution stopped by January 1.
I thought we were taking out the date.
We're taking out January 1. Or have their distribution stopped and returned to the TCTO any CWR fund balance.
Okay. Did you get that? September 26, 2015, or have distribution stopped and returned to the TCTF any CWR fund balance, period.
Any other questions or thoughts? Judge Conklin.
I may have dismissed it, but is there language in here requiring those courts that do not operate to notify us by July?
Good question, Judge. And that's – Stephen and I were talking about that. That's well put us back to that very first bullet. The onus is on the court to do so.
Is there a penalty if they don't?
There's not. And our committee did talk about that, not wanting to get into very specific – directives, this must occur, because there may be disputes. In that case, they're just directed to return back to the return their request or their discussion back to this committee in those cases.
Any other questions, thoughts? Is there a motion to approve the recommendations of the work group?
Sorry, Lori, can I ask where that is again?
D1.
Oh, okay.
Chow monitor. A little more passive when we started.
I didn't hear who moved.
I'll move.
Judge David did, and Chris Volker second. Is there further discussion, Judge Harmon? Did you have a question?
No, I was just trying to see if it really put the onus on the courts if they never operated one.
I do have a question, but I don't see that.
I don't see it either.
I'm not trying.
I'm reading D1, and I don't see that.
It says shall monitor. It doesn't say anything about notifying.
And it doesn't say that, especially if they never operated one.
So in C, temporarily or permanently ceased, it's in there. We can pull the same language. Courts that cease operating must notify the director. If we put that same, we don't need to. Where is that? It is in the first bullet. I'm sorry. Thank you, Jake. Yeah. Courts that receive distributions between January 1, 2006 and January 30, 2014, but did not operate a CWR during that time period, must either apply for a continued distribution or have it stopped. and the Judicial Council Finance Office is aware of those courts, as I said. Is it two or three?
Technically three. Yeah,
okay. Three. So it's only three courts, and those three have already been directed. It says in here that they have to return it. They've already been identified, so there would be ongoing discussions. That would be the expectation.
So by not notifying, they are notifying.
Yes. We've already been notified. I guess that's the best way to put it.
All right.
And it sounds like the finance office knows who those courts are.
That's correct. What we did not put into policy, again, this will go away after this year. This item E, it won't apply because going forward we won't have situations due to the rest of the process being in place. The issue is we did not get into discussions of penalty. They would have to go before the council, I suppose.
Any other discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed? Thank you, Kimberly.
Thank you.
Next item is item three, amendments to the statute requiring a 2% reserve held in the trial court's trust fund, and Rick Feldstein is going to walk us through this one.
Okay. So if you turn to page 17 in your materials, that's the report related to this particular item. And this came about as related to the efforts to deal with the 2% holdback and some of the problems that we've experienced over the years related to that holdback, and particularly the fact that we usually get the money very late in the year. It's difficult for planning. With the 1% reserve, of course, if you get it late in the year, you can bump up against your reserve, and there's various problems related to that that we've tried to deal with. A committee was formed to put together recommendations to change that process. That committee consists of Judge Earl, Judge Cope, Judge Good, Mike Roddy, Sherry Carter, Mary Beth Todd, David Yamasaki, and Slatko Theodorovic. They came back and proposed changes to the actual process that we went through already this year, so I think everybody's pretty familiar with that. It mostly had to change the way that money was distributed throughout the year, where 75% of the 2% gets redistributed to the courts around January 1st. The remaining 25% can be applied for between January 1st and March 15th for emergencies, unanticipated costs, things along those lines, and that, of course, any money coming back that's left over comes back to the courts after March 1st. And if there are unanticipated needs after March 15th, those are handled on a loan basis or a cash advance basis. So the other proposal, though, was related to the legislation itself, and that's what we need to talk about today. The committee looked at five basic options, and those start on the second page of at the bottom of your handout there. And the options that were considered were, first of all, to kind of let the process play out a little bit, go through the distribution process and the holdback and then the application process for a year or two, and then determine if changes needed to be made to the legislation and what those changes might be. So that was one option. The second option at the top of the next page was to change the 2% down to only a half of 1%. And the reason being is that looking at past experience related to how much of that money was needed at the end of the year, it was very little as compared to the total amount that was being withheld. So in the proposed language that you see under that option, you'll see that 2% would be changed to half of 1%. Otherwise, everything would remain the same. Option three that was considered is the Judicial Council would determine the amount to be held back, and that could be kind of a flexible approach, either a percentage of the total of the court's budget, as it is 2% now, or some other percentage, or just simply a flat amount. And that the Judicial Council would then be responsible for determining the appropriate process and timing for the applications to use that fund on an emergency basis. Option four was similar to that, except for it would change option three, that the money that would be withheld would not come out of our budgets after the allocation decisions were made, but rather the amount, whether it be a percentage or a flat amount, would be just simply taken off the trial court trust fund as soon as that amount was known. And then in addition to that, it would roll over every year. We wouldn't go through the process of holding it back. It would just stay in the reserve if it's not used, and then whatever is used would be replenished off the top in a similar fashion. So that would be option four. If you have questions about these options, feel free to let me know as I go through them. Option five is very similar, except for it puts a cap on the amount that would be held back. So it would be equal to the 0.5% of the 14-15 budget. And in terms of real dollars, that comes out to about $9.5 million. So that cap would remain from year to year. And just like option four, it would be taken off the top. It would roll over from year to year, and we wouldn't be dealing with having to reduce our budgets every year for that reason. And then, again, the Judicial Council would determine the process for applying for and the uses of that money. So we considered all of those various options, and we're actually recommending option five, the last option that you see there. This would be, have to, again, be a change to statute, but hopefully we would be able to add it to the budget trailer bill this year. To be effective later on. So any questions on that?
Judge Smith.
I have one, and that is the 0.5%.
Mm-hmm.
How do you know that's going to be enough? I mean, do you feel that they need even more flexibility if that's not enough and coming up with something else? Or
right, right.
Some other formula?
Well, just in looking back at the experience of how much is needed from year to year, it appeared to be enough going forward.
It's only been several hundred thousand
this
last year. So something that's approaching almost $10 million, I think the less that's held in reserve, the more you know and have certainty with all 58 courts as to what you're going to have.
Right.
And wasn't that the approximate amount that was required to be held over out of the IMF at one point?
Yeah, that was also a calculation, and that ranged based on amounts that were in the TCTF, but it ranged from 9 to 13. It was a calculation, and so this, again, will be a calculated value, but that's the approximate amount that it'll be. And I think, you know, if that were the case, we have some pretty – we'd be going to the state if we needed more than $10 million.
Yeah. Judge Johnson?
So the money that's given to courts under the emergency – provisions, that's a loan, right?
It depends. They can be loans, and they can be just outright augmentations to a budget.
Okay, so
depends on the circumstance of the type of expense and their ability to repay the loan.
So this could be depleted over time.
If it were done as a one-time, I think, if I understand this, there could be one-time amount, or it could be a pull back, give, and so those are different options that have been presented.
Right, right. So they would withhold the 0.5% this year, and then it would be just roll over from year to year and be available each year. But if some of it actually gets used for emergency needs, it would be replenished from that following year's allocation to the TCTF.
I see. Okay. Kim Turner.
So I like option five from a trial court's perspective because it gives us more predictability in terms of what we will get in our budgets. We don't have this little math problem that comes around March every year. So the idea of having an amount of $9.5 million sort of siphoned off the top in 15-16, and then that becomes we just take it out of our mental equation. So that the court then would get whatever distribution it gets thereafter, and we no longer have to continually be concerned about whether or not we're going to get a late influx of money or something of that nature. So I think option five is the best option of the five.
Yeah. And certainty, getting to that budgetary certainty is really the key.
It really is.
And
there's so many moving parts as you get toward the end of the fiscal year anyway. You don't need one more monkey wrench in the works, as you're coming upon your final quarter.
And not only the uncertainty about what happens at the end of the year, but now at the beginning of the year, you'll know pretty much what you can plan on, because we always face the issue at the beginning of the year, well, how much money do we plan to get back, and how do we weave that into our budget? So once it's withdrawn, it's out there, assuming nobody has another earthquake or other cataclysmic event, you can account that you won't have to, it won't come out of this year's budget or the following year budget, only just to replenish whatever small amounts are needed.
So I would move approval of option 5.
Second.
There was a second by Judge Smith. Sean, did you have a?
I have an option 5 makes perfect sense to me. But my question is, so we currently have money in there now that is above that 0.5%. What happens to that money? If so, what happens to that
this
pot
year's
of money?
Money has all been distributed.
Mm-hmm. So, okay.
So there's no remaining funds.
Any other question? Jake.
So just clarifying, but it would be that 0.5% gets recalculated every year. So while in the current year, let's say it gets passed and we're in 16-17 and there's 0.5% and no money is taken out of it, if there is any augmentation out of the trial court trust fund, there would be 0.5% of whatever that increase is that would be taken out the following year. Right, so it would always maintain 0.5% of what not, it's not fixed at 0.5% of what we get now, it's 0.5% growing, so.
Up to the 9.5.
Or decreasing, right. So we all kind of have that in the back of our mind that, yeah, on the one hand you could plan for, well, 100,000 was taken out, so my share of that's going to be blank. You'd also have to be thinking, well, if we get 100 million of new money, 500,000 of that is going to come out just to fill the fund.
But I think what Rick had just said is up to $9.5 million.
Right.
So it's replenished to that level.
The cap is based upon this 0.5% of this year's budget.
Up to $9.5 million.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Judge Smith, did you have a comment?
No.
Judge Harmon.
If this year it's empty and we had 2%, then how is 0.5% going to be enough?
Distributed back to the
court. Oh, it's already been distributed back to the courts. Okay.
But requests were several hundred thousand dollars of the $37 million that was set aside, so.
Judge Cope?
No, it was covered. Thank you.
David Yamasaki.
Yeah, and I just wanted to mention that historically, I think this program has been in place for a number of years, and we have never distributed anything near that $9.5 million in previous years, so it really creates a solid buffer should situations arise. So I think that figure is pretty good.
Judge Boris.
Yeah, so if we don't spend money once we reach the 9.5 or the 9.5 million, then every year after that, as long as no money is spent, the courts would not get anything withheld and they'd get 100% back?
Correct.
Nothing being taken out.
Right.
Yep.
So you know exactly how much.
Speak up, Patrick, please.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes. This is Patrick. It would roll over. It would be, so it's 0.5% of the Budget Act appropriation for this year, for 2014, and it would roll over. If there were any requests, then it would be replenished up to that $9.5 million.
But once it's deposited, if there's no withdrawals, there'd be no subsequent need for a withdrawal or a transfer from you to fill it.
Right.
If it was depleted, we'd have to come back and get it again.
Yeah. So say it was $9.5 million this year and they used $1 million of it.
The
following year, they'd only take $1 million off the top of the trial court trust fund. But then you still know how much you're going to get at the beginning of the year and can plan for it well.
I say that technically speaking, I think we have to make the language be explicit because the way it's written, and I think it's the way Jake read it, is that if it's 9.5% of an amount,
no.
But it needs to be an amount, but no more than $9.5 million in order for that to be the fixed amount that you're talking about.
Right.
Yeah, that is correct.
Mike Roddy.
Really off-the-wall question. So if the money continues to stay in the fund, I would assume that it's invested in the standard investment options and that interest earnings accrue. And if so, is that the case, and what do we do with it? And hopefully someday we get back to some real interest earnings.
TCTF, Truck or Trust Fund, is part of the state's pooled money investment, and so it does fractions, but that's where so we do have small amounts of interest. But on the entirety of the Truck or Trust Fund balance.
Does it go back into
it's just
fund?
Part of revenues, yeah. We've reported it's one of the top lines of our revenues. Yes, and it would be available for allocation. So I think we'd have to revise the language to reflect that it is 0.5% of the amount, but no more than $9.5 million.
Does anyone want to make that friendly amendment?
I'll accept that friendly amendment.
All right. So the language would be
set aside no more than 0.5% of the total funds appropriated in Program 4510 of item blank of the 2014 Budget Act.
And no more than?
Not to exceed.
Not to exceed.
Not to exceed $9.5 million.
And who seconded that?
I did.
Judge Smith, will you accept that amendment as well?
Yes.
I think we'd have to drop the 2014 so that it's just the budget, annual budget act.
So it's every, so that it's every year. So right now annual is stricken out. And what Zlotko is saying, the 2014 should be stricken. It should just be the annual budget act.
Mm-hmm.
Do you accept that amendment?
I do.
Judge Smith?
Do I? Yes.
We have a request to repeat back here.
Yes. So,
zero.
The second line will read, starting with, the Judicial Council shall set aside no more than 0.5% of the total funds appropriated in Program 4510 of item, and then the number, of the Annual Budget Act, comma, not to exceed $9.5 million, and these funds shall remain in the Trial Court Trust Fund. Kimberly?
So for clarification, let's go forward to 2017 Budget Act, and it's a lower allocation. So 0.5% actually equates to $8 million, not 9.5, but there's 9.5 in there. What are we doing there? I'm just trying to understand why you're having it both.
I don't necessarily have a problem with the amendment, but I do think that it is changing the intent of what the recommendation was, because I think what the recommendation was really trying to say is that we're going to put a fixed amount, and I'm sorry if I was not clear, it would not be recalculated every year. This fixed amount would be equal to 0.5% of this year's trial court trust fund budget.
Well, then just
and
put
it's always going to be $9.5 million.
Then we don't need the 0.5%. We just identify in the language $9.5 million and call it a day.
Yeah, I think we're just trying to say where the 9.5 comes from.
Okay, well, then the trailer language would have to change so that it just says the amount.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So set aside no more than $9.5 million from the funds appropriated in Program 4510 of 0250101 of the Annual Budget Act.
Correct.
And that's and those.
I accept that friendly
that
amendment.
That is clear.
The amendment of the amendment of the amendment.
So we switch it to 9.5
million? Yeah. So shall set aside no more than $9.5 million of the total funds appropriated in Program 4510 of item 0250-101-0932 of the Annual Budget Act, and these funds shall remain in the Trial Court Trust Fund.
Further thoughts on that? So we do have a first and a second. I'll call the question. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion carries. We have had a couple folks who have joined us, and I want to update our attendance. Judge Boris is here. Rebecca Fleming is here. And Judge Smith is here. And Chris Volkers is here. Is there anyone on the phone that I've missed? All right. Thank you. The next item on our agenda is item number 4. Allocation of proposed restored funding for retirement cost changes, reconsideration of our March 23rd action item. We tried to clarify this in an email. It might have gotten muddier. So we have it back on today for Chris Volkers to walk us through it.
Thanks, Judge Earl. This is like a boomerang. I hope it's the last time this thing circles back here. Okay, so I draw your attention to page 108. My page is different than your pages for some reason, but page 108 of the materials, item 4, paragraph called reconsideration of allocation methodology options. You know everything that led up to this point. So on May 14th, the Benefit Working Group met again, had another lively discussion again, and came up with the proposal, as you see outlined here. Basically, if you recall, at the last Trial Court Budget Advisory Committee, we had several options. At the last minute, we introduced option 3A and 3B. While our words explained option 3B, the materials explained option 3A. So if you look towards the back of this item on the materials, you'll see item 3A, that is the same as was handed out in March at this meeting. And if you flip it over, you'll see option 3B, that's the same. We're including a clarification, which we're calling 3C. Okay? So our recommendation is what you're looking at now, the option 3B and 3C. So what we tried to do, you'll notice through the materials, the definition, we got tired of saying number one. First, we got tired of saying employer paid share, so EPS. We have another acronym we're using for purposes of this discussion. So anybody who sees EPS, that's employer paid share. So what we're outlining here in option 3C is 3B with a couple clarifications, as I said, and that is outlined on page 110. And I'm going to go through the italics under 3C, and the only thing we're adding is courts will be included in the additional 50%. Remember, the first 50% goes to everybody, okay, of the monies that are returned. We are referencing it as $10.8 million, and then we think it's $13.4 million, and it could go up even more once we get the final numbers. Right, Patrick?
We're actually, I think 13.4
is it? Okay. So pretend it's 13.4. So 50% of that will be allocated to everybody. The other 50%, okay, will be allocated to those, I'm on the second bullet under 3C, that meet any of the three criteria, any of the courts that meet the three criteria. For courts that do not at all subsidize any part of the employer paid share, to courts where only 10% or less is paid towards the employer paid share, and to courts in which the employer paid share portion has been reduced by at least 30%. Now, that's all the same as last time, okay? This is where we add a clarification this meeting and this proposal to you today. Third bullet, courts will be included in the additional 50% proration if they meet the defined criteria by May 14th, and that was the date of our last discussion. We believe that there perhaps were courts, we didn't know at the discussion, but perhaps there were courts that has made some movement in this area. Jay called all of them, and Patrick worked together, and we found out then there must not be any more courts, right?
Yeah, there's only one court that actually would meet that criteria from what we know, and the amount would be minuscule. It would be under $1,000, actually around $700 statewide impact.
Okay. Okay, so that was the additional language we're bringing to you today based on the information we had at the time. The last bullet on page 110, beginning in 2016, 2017, we needed to clarify what would happen after this next fiscal year. Courts that continue to provide the employer paid share of the employee retirement contribution would be reduced by the actual. So basically, if there is restoration, you don't get, or if there's, I'm sorry, not restoration, if there is a repayment or contribution towards the employer-paid benefits, those courts that are contributing anything would not get anything. So in summary, my court, for example, me and the commissioners contribute, the court contributes towards our employee-paid share. We have taken care of everybody else. Starting in 16-17, I wouldn't get any benefit restoration. What would happen is they'd reduce my allocation by that amount. Did I explain it right, Sean? You're looking at me weird.
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay.
So the amount of money that you're contributing towards that retirement is the exact amount, the actual amount you would be reduced.
Exactly.
Right.
So no credit, no assistance, I should say.
For that actual amount that you're spending on it.
Starting in 16-17. That's correct. Is everybody clear on that? Okay. So those are the recommendations of the subcommittee. You can see on the next page, we are recommending that the adoption of option 3C with that clarifying language of 3 in addition to 3B.
Does anyone want either Chris or Stephen or Patrick to go through the spreadsheet that's included?
I draw your attention, that's a good question, Judge Earl. Let me just draw your attention, though, to the columns. It's hard to read here. F and G, those are the additional amounts, F and G, that your court, if any, would get.
What's
So column F is everybody gets 50%, right, of the 13.4 million. Column G is only those that meet the criteria that we outlined in the proposal. Jake.
Okay, so I just want to clarify the 16-17 item because we had a really hard time defining what that meant. So I didn't figure it out until after Patrick and I talked about it, and then I looked at the spreadsheet. So essentially what we're saying is, as Chris said, the recommendation is the columns F and G is what each quarter we get additional to what you already received from that benefits increase from several years ago in the current year. So everybody shares in 50% of what's been returned back, and then those that meet the three criteria would share in the other 50%. But in 16-17, if you are a court that has any money or any contribution that is listed in column E, then you would not get that kind of money. So that could be an actual reduction to your court, so that the rest of the courts that are currently at 90% would go to 100% because they are providing no contribution, and that amount that's being reduced to all of us is because of a very small number of courts potentially. So we just want to make sure that's really clear, that you sort of look at, we have A as the total cost increases we're talking about, and E is the amount that's being withheld. So 16-17, if your court's in E, then that is an exact amount that you would not get, which might result in a negative. So the balance of courts get to 100% of what their column A is. I hope that helps.
Alan Carlson.
Now I'm confused. So take Chris's example on San Bernardino. So right now in column E, she's got 169,200, and because that's in there, in 16-17 she would not get 169,200, or she would not get the 246,900 in column G.
Okay, so
which one's the one you don't get?
So for Chris, so let's see, we're going, okay, hold on. So San Bernardino, right?
Yeah.
She would end up next year receiving 1.993070 in column A, less 169,200.
So the only amount reduced is what's in E.
Yeah.
Right. So, okay. But let's. But that also means, let's take Mariposa for example. That means Mariposa would have a positive 5,321 and a negative 40,136. So they would get the net of those two numbers.
Okay.
Okay. Oh, I don't want to do that one. Okay.
Yeah, it's
that. So, all right, for San Luis Obispo, since that was the question, San Luis Obispo would get the net of 182,698 minus 870,337.
We're in trouble.
And that's the only way, so that all those courts that aren't paying that share have 100% of what their benefit cost increase was. So I just want to make sure that was clear because we had a hard time explaining how to define that.
Any other thoughts or questions? Is there a motion to adopt the recommendation of the working group?
I'll move.
Second.
Thank you, Judge Conklin. Second. Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
No.
Judge Boris. Anyone else? The motion carries. I do want to go back to item three just for a minute. The 2% reserve action that we took today, our original charter was to work with the trial court presiding judge advisory committee and SEAC and the judicial council's internal committee, PCLC. So I want to make sure that we're in agreement that the action we took today, does everyone agree that we would ask Mary Beth, Rick, and Judge Slough to present it to the budget presiding judge advisory committee and SEAC for their input and approval? And if they disagree, to bring it back to us? Is that agreeable?
That is agreeable.
All right.
So the chairs will see the wisdom.
Right. Well, I'm sure the SEAC chair will.
Do you think you'll present that to SEAC and TCPJAC?
Our next TCPJAC meeting is first week of June.
I think you're June 5th, and we're June 11th. So soon.
Assuming we have time to put those in our agenda, our public agenda, then we could get it on it as that that early.
Maybe we'll put this on our July 6th agenda just to report back from you, if that's okay. All right.
Yep.
Thank you. I need to skip item 5 until after lunch to accommodate the schedules. So I am going to go to, can we jump to item 7, which is the allocations for the V3 case management system and intermediate case management systems. Judge Slower, are you able to go on that?
I think I am.
And I believe is Mark Desmond here. Mark, do you want to come on up to provide feedback, information, and answer any questions that we may have?
So just to kind of refresh recollection and give you a little bit of the quick history on this, you all may recall that the Revenue and Expenditure Subcommittee, which is chaired by myself and Sherry Carter, who is stuck on a plane. And
she's walking through the door.
Ah, perfect timing.
Saved by the bell.
My heart rate just went down. Actually, it didn't, because Chris Volkers just told me our full bench meeting is on the same date as our PJ meeting.
I could have the date wrong.
I hope so.
Hi.
Hi. So in any event, just to give you a little quick reminder, on March 10 and 11, we convened the Revenue and Expenditure Subcommittee, which is an exercise we've done for the last, I don't know, 3 or 4 years or more, to go over a line item by line item evaluation of the expenditures in the IMF fund. At that time, the recommendation of the subcommittee at the conclusion of those 2 days of meetings was as follows. It was to lower by 20% from 14-15 allocation the IMF and the ICMS funding. The March 23rd Trial Court Budget Advisory Committee, we all considered all of the allocation recommendations or issue recommendations from that subcommittee work. And we, at the suggestion of Judge Earle, we decided to defer action as it relates to the IMF and the ICMS funding so as to give time to collaborate with Judicial Council Technology Committee, as they also were working on the IMF issue as it relates to the V3 courts. So we held off on that issue. The Revenue and Expenditure Subcommittee met again on April 2nd to further evaluate particularly the V3 and ICMS funding. On April 17, the Judicial Council met and adopted the Judicial Council Technology Committee's recommendation as it relates to V3 and ICMS. And Ms. Carter and others, if I misstate that, please make sure you correct me. Basically, what it was determined was that the funding would continue as it was previously, but there was no actual dollar amount included in the recommendation. And also Judicial Council Technology Committee also agreed to work with the Budget Advisory Committee on this issue. So we've all got back together again, and the recommendation as it relates to V3 and ICMS now is as follows. To hold them steady as it relates to their funding as it was back in the budget year 14-15. That would be $5.6 million as it relates to V3 and $1.2 million as it relates to ICMS. However, if the IMF fund balance dropped below $300,000, then 10% reduction, which would total $690,508,000, should be reduced from V3 and ICMS. That number would not be charged to the courts directly. However, it would be a backfill from Judicial Council Information and Technology Center. So Right now, the projection as it relates to the IMF fund is that it would end, and again, this is the projection as of today, recognizing that it could fluctuate. But right now, the projected end balance would be $476,000. So again, the recommendation is to hold steady from the 14-15 and only have a 10% reduction if the fund balance drops below 300,000, that would not, again, would not come from the trial courts themselves. So that's the recommendation, and I don't know if Sherry or Mark or anybody else has any comments before we open up for questions.
So we do have Mark Dustman here from the Judicial Council IT office. Mark, thank you for being here today. So right ahead.
Just one comment, Judge Lyle and Judge Earl, if you would allow. The V3, just to clarify what Judge Lyle said, what JCTC and then the Judicial Council voted on at their last meeting was specific to V3. It did not include ICMS. So JCTC was working only with the V3 courts. It had not moved forward with ICMS, so the council's action was specific to V3. From the perspective of my office, we've looked at the impact to the programs based on the council's recommendation and also looking forward to what you may be considering today. The impact to V3 looks like it's something that could be handled by deferring a major upgrade on the equipment for V3. Since the objective is to get V3 replaced with different case management systems, we feel that this is, while a risk to the V3 courts, it is something that we could ask the courts to take on as a risk. So from a budgetary perspective, that program, by deferring that upgrade, and using the savings for continued operations is something we could do. On the ICMS program, the difference between 14-15 and what we projected for 15-16 is about 40% of the budget. So it's much more significant for ICMS, and we have not talked in great detail with the courts that would be impacted, but at this point, it looks like, since that program really only has two major components, one being the hosting cost at SAIC and the other being the contracts for sustain and contractors to help the courts do their interface work projects, the impact, if we were to move ahead with the decision to keep 14-15 funds, would be that we would eliminate probably disaster recovery for that particular program. So if there were a disaster, the courts would need to be in a manual mode as opposed to the 72-hour disaster recovery program we have at the CCTC. In addition, we would need to eliminate a large portion of the sustain contract, meaning that if there were problems that we couldn't handle internally, we would have only a very small amount of money. We're looking about $50,000 to keep sustain in contract with us. The kind of domino effect also would occur as we begin decommissioning the disaster recovery and other servers to save funds. The folks that we would normally have working on there's about 8 or 9 projects which the sustained courts are either in the midst of right now or would be in the next fiscal year, those programs would need to be put on hold while we worked on decommissioning the servers to save funding. So this has these programs typically are to automate payments using IVR and IWR. And that's how the courts have used automation to help deal with some of the challenges that their operating budgets have faced over the past several years. As I said, we wouldn't make any final decisions about how we would take this reduction without working very closely with all the sustained courts. But I just wanted to point out to this committee that this program has a much bigger impact to the courts than the reduction for the V3 courts program. Happy to answer any questions you may have.
Yes, Sherry Carter.
Just to address that, I wanted to remind the group that the Revenue and Expenditure Committee unanimously approved as a principle that the funding levels or the expenditure levels would stay at 14-15. They did have to violate that principle, I think, on one occasion because of the age of some equipment, and it was a very small purchase. But keeping it at the 14-15 level did not mean it had to come out of the sustain or the ICMS budget, but your entire budget in total. And it was commented that there might be other areas within your entire budget that you could find the money necessary to support the sustained courts. One of the examples that was used is because CCPOR is on hold now because there's no money to expand it, if there's contractors or others that could be let go to support the sustained court, that was one example. So I just wanted to remind this group that it was a unanimous recommendation from the R&E subcommittee, and it was not saying that you needed to find the money out of the sustained V3 budget, but out of your entire budget, we were hoping that you could find resources to have the money stay at the 14-15 level, but find the other money within your budget.
Debbie?
Nori? As one of the sustained courts, we are moving aggressively towards dealing with the costs at the tech center. Mark's staff had a conference call with the CEOs from the SJE courts last Thursday, talked about a lot of the things that he has mentioned, and Judge Herman and the technology committee have a meeting scheduled to deal with the sustained justice courts on the 20th, a telephone conference, and Rick Feldstein's involved. I'm going to be there, and Tammy Grimm from Imperial will all be involved. We understand we need to reduce costs or leave the tech center, so we are all committed to doing whatever we can to meet that challenge.
Thank you, David. Jake Chatters.
So I had a question. I had a couple questions. So one is, so Sherry, what you're saying is the recommendation is to keep the ICMS expenses at the 14-15 amount.
Right.
So I guess, Mark, my question is what's the difference? I mean, it probably was in the materials before and I can't find it. But so what difference are we talking about? So you were then asking for 15-16?
$745,247.
Okay. So we're talking about $700,000. I guess then the second question is one of your comments is about disaster recovery. So leaving that off to the side. The other one is it would reduce down to $50,000 to work with sustain in the event of any major problem, right? So how much has been spent over the last, you know, annually over the last several years with sustain for those issues?
Closer to 200
per year.
1,000 per year, yes.
But that's not just issues, that's also legislative changes?
It's, yes, you're correct, it's all changes.
Any other questions for Mark? All right, thank you, Mark.
Judge, before you move on to another item, since I'm here, I could bring up one other anomaly on another program. I'll just take 1 minute to explain this, but the action of this committee earlier was to eliminate IMF funding for the CLETS program and have us work with the courts that are using that program to fund it themselves. So we've had those meetings. And we're moving in that direction. We don't have a definitive answer from the courts that are using that program at this time. But at the time, we also pointed out that the CCPOR program in its maintenance mode for supporting the 40 courts that will be on by the end of this year use several components of the CLETS program to connect to the Department of Justice. And that budget is in the CLETS program. It's not in CCPOR. So I just want to point out, and I think the actual language that came out of the recommendations from this committee was that we would come back in October with the impacts to CCPOR. But my contention is October is probably too late since CCPOR, since CLETS will stop on July 1st, CCPR needs to continue running if that's the intention. So I want to point out that for next year's budget, we're looking at about $145,000 that would have to be added to CCPR to keep it going if we were to eliminate CLETS. Just the components from CLETS, that's not the whole CLETS budget, but just the components that need to be there to keep CCPR connected to the Department of Justice is about $145,000. So I just wanted to point out to you that the actual recommendation timing of having us come back in October doesn't really work logistically.
Could you come back in July?
I can.
At our July 6th meeting?
Of course.
All right. Why don't we make sure we put it on calendar for that meeting?
We'll do.
Thank you. Judge Slough.
I think this last item, 7, was an action item.
It is.
Okay.
Is there a motion to approve the recommendation by the Revenue and Expenditure Subcommittee?
So moved.
Judge Harmon?
I'll second.
And Judge Cope? 1 second. Any further discussion?
Yes, please.
Yes.
I'm still a little trying to wrap my head around the whole piece of the recommendation where we say we dictate how the Judicial Council is going to spend money. And I'm trying to understand that a little better, where we're saying we're not going to pay for it from IMF. And I understand we got to get IMF whole, but I guess I'm just a little uncomfortable where we say, and so if the fund balance dips too low, then Judicial Council IS has to make up the difference. And I realize the difference has to be made up somewhere, and I'm good with kind of calling out the difference will have to be made up somewhere. I'm just a little uncomfortable with being so prescriptive.
I understand your thought or expression. I think one of the things that the recommendation tried to balance was the fact that some of the courts that are impacted so negatively by the V3 issue in particular are also the courts that are, A, working on transitioning in, spending dollars on transitioning into new case management systems at the same time that they are negatively impacted by WAFM. So they find themselves in a real difficult spot to address it with their own home dollars. And so I think that was one of the issues that we balanced against, where could the difference come from? So it was that was part and parcel of that evaluation.
I guess my level of discomfort is that we've got our charge with respect to the local funds, the IMF and the TCTF, but once, I don't know how our authority extends to make recommendations with respect to the Judicial Council budget, and that's why I'm thinking something more broad might be more palatable, which is we'll have to look to other sources to make up the difference if it tips below this level rather than specifically from this department. Unless what I thought maybe I was missing was that there were something along the lines of what Mark was describing. I thought, that makes sense that there's some part of those costs that are within their budget and would come from there. But then Sherry's explanation indicated maybe that wasn't what the intent was. So I'm still a little confused there.
Given the fact that the IMF fund was facing an $11 million fund balance
deficit,
thank you, the options are just very, very limited. So I think really my question would be what other source would you have in mind if you were more comfortable changing it to something other than a recommendation coming from information technology?
I guess I would be teeing it up to the Judicial Council that they would take a look at where they think it could come from if we're looking to the Judicial Council budget to make up that difference. And they very well may go to IT to make that cut, but that we would leave it up to the administrative director to make a recommendation to the council as to how best to make up that shortfall.
Kim Turner and then Judge Johnson.
So I also wanted to just add that I understand Mary Beth's concern, and
I think the Revenue and Expenditure Subcommittee had a similar concern, and so we're convening a subcommittee of the subcommittee, I think it's this Thursday, to do kind of a deeper dive into the JCIS budget and the various programs that are funded there with some specific focus to better understand what you know, what's in that budget and also the impacts of any kind of adverse action that we take here will have on that budget going forward. So maybe it would be opportune to come back at the July 6th meeting and report back on what the R&E subcommittee finds out from that further analysis of what's in the IS budget. So I think we all struggle with not really understanding, you know, the various silos of money in that IS budget, and when CCPOR, you know, something wiggles something here, it pops up, you know, in a very adverse way on the other side of the ledger. So a lot of things are interconnected. We don't have a full and complete understanding of that, and I think it's important that we do have such an understanding going forward.
Judge Johnson.
Well, I agree with Mary Beth that it's sort of rude for us to be directing how things should be done at the Judicial Council level. But knowing the work that's being done to better understand these sources of funds and how they are spread over the various programs, technology programs, and recognizing that the oversight of the technology center and so forth is also spread out and somewhat fragmented, I think that the point is that the Judicial Council needs to be apprised of our concern and given some direction about where to go, because they're the end of the line. And if we're not taking some responsibility for saying it could come out of this pot, or we're looking into other sources, I don't think we're quite doing our job either. Perhaps a way to smooth it over would be to say, at this point, you know, the recommendation is that the money come out of the Judicial Council Information Technology Office's budget or other source that the Judicial Council prefers, and just leave it open after providing as much information as we can about where the money seems to be available.
Does anyone want to, Mary Beth, did you want to propose alternative language?
Well, I like Kim's suggestion. If it can wait, I don't know, you know, where we are in the continuum, whether it can wait or not. I think if we want, I like Judge Johnson's suggestion in that we show some due diligence as it appears it could come from here. And if we could at least say that and soften it a little bit, that we're not saying, and this definitely, but if we've done a deeper dive, we can see, because we do have this tangled web of IMF and non-IMF, and we see that where these changes in IMF might result in some savings in other areas. I like that idea, that we're providing them with some, you know, we did our deeper dive. This is where we think it can come from. I'm just a little honestly, I think the work of the, you know, the recommendation in every other respect is great. I understand we have to say we need to deal with this, and it's going to have to come from somewhere else if the balance gets too low. I just would feel more comfortable we stopped a little short of saying, and it will come from this division if we say, and we think there are savings there, or we think it should be explored for that. Just soften it up a little bit. I just think we need to be respectful of kind of where our charge begins and ends.
So my memory is that the other recommendations that the Revenue and Expenditure Subcommittee made that included reductions to program budgets either had language that said if the Judicial Council believes this is a priority, it can determine or where and if funding should be provided for it, or we were silent on it. It's just a reduction, period. And the program or the folks themselves can determine how to adjust to that. Sherry?
You know, I don't think it can wait. We had an $11.5 million deficit on the IMF side, and we're overspending trial court trust fund funding by about $5 million a year. So I absolutely have no concern with the language if someone wants to propose your language, because it really, if we don't have any money on the trial court trust fund side, and we don't have any money on the IMF side, that just leaves general fund. So, you know, I think that clearly it's up to the council where it would like to try to find the funds or if there's some other alternative as well. And so I would, if that was a motion, I would second it. I think that gives the council more flexibility. If that's what the goal is, to try to do that, I think that would, you know, that would be fine. But we can't pretend like we don't have a problem. You know, the Revenue and Expenditure Committee for the third year in a row spent 2 days together. And in that 2 years, we had to find a solution to $11.5 million hole, knowing that the Trial Court Trust Fund has a $5 million spending problem. So there is no money, and I would second. If that's a motion, I would second it.
Yeah, one second. Can you articulate your thoughts, or do you want a minute?
Well, I was just looking at the language of the recommendation in the first paragraph, which says that after the figure $690,500 and the costs associated with the reduction are to be backfilled from the Judicial Council Information Technology Office's budget or such other source as the Judicial Council deems appropriate.
I think that was Judge Harmon made a motion, I think.
Right, but I think that we need the other thing that we talked about, though, is it's not to come from any portion of the trial court trust fund either, and that's what's missing if we add that language.
Doesn't say general fund source, such other general fund source.
It's a general fund source, because mm-hmm. that was the constant discussion here, was mm-hmm. that the courts are taking the hit, and some of this has to go back to judicial counsel staff.
Right, I agree with that.
You want to try again?
Okay. So after the period following the word budget, that would just be changed to a comma, and then it would be or such other general fund source as the council deems appropriate.
Now, I think that might limit it slightly, only because it could be that there may be some other source that we're unaware of. I don't know what that would be, but maybe what we would say yes.
Or how about if we said, or non-trial court trust fund source?
I think that's better.
Okay.
Or such other non-trial court trust fund source?
Yeah.
So it would be, or such other non-trial court trust fund source. Funding source.
Funding source, yeah.
As the Judicial Council deems appropriate. Do we have a motion yet?
I think Judge Harmon.
Will you accept that amendment?
Yes.
And Judge Cope, will you accept the second the amendment?
Sounds great.
Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
No.
All right. The motion carries. We are going to turn to item number 9. Which is the workload-based allocation and funding methodology. We will hear this item before we take a break. And we have Jake Chatters and Stephen Chang who will be presenting, and Colin Simpson.
Okay, so we're on page 73 if it's on paper, or 74 if you're in the PDF. So this item is a discussion item. There's no action on it yet. So this is the update of the workload-based allocation and funding methodology. It represents an update to the filings numbers, so adding the 13-14 filings to the three-year average, which means the first year last year drops off. Updating the BLS salary data for the additional year of 2013. Updating the salary and benefit information off of the court's 7As based on the 14, 15, 7A information. Besides those, the model itself did not have any changes this year in the actual calculation, so the updates were to the data inputs into the model, not the actual model itself. Collins can walk through most of the detailed spreadsheets, but at a very high level, there was overall a $55.3 million decrease in the total need, which is about 2.3%, and the memo itself walks through those individual percentages based on where those came from. So we're really going to focus on three tabs and tables in the spreadsheet today, 9B, and we'll walk through them as we go through, but 9B, 9C, and 9I. The others are largely there just for background information for you so you can see where the information came from, but we aren't going to spend a whole lot of time on those unless there's questions just so that we can move through it, because there aren't any changes in how those calculations occurred, just the update of the data. So, Colin, if you want to start with 9B.
And just to note, the attachments that we're going to look at, there are 9B is on page 75, 9C is on 76 through 79, and 9I is on page 87.
And again, for anyone who's using the PDF, add one page number to each of those.
So looking at attachment 9B, this is a summary of the changes to the total WAFM need based on individual variables that impact that calculation. So the first variable that had them, and they're ordered in order of significance or the size of the impact. So the first item, the FTE need decrease, had the most significant impact. It decreased the calculated WAFM need by about $97 million, or about 4%. And you can see that in column H and column I. The benefits increase, that decreased the increased the calculated estimated need by about $26.2 million, about 1.1%. And the average RAS-related salary, it increased by about $412, or about 0.7%, which increased the calculated WAFM need by about $12.7 million. And then the BLS salary adjustment had a minimal impact. It increased it by about $2.9 million. So moving on to attachment 9C, this is just the WAFM calculation. It just provides the details. So I'm not going to go through this in any detail. I'm just going to remind you that this provides the calculation for the WAFM need, and I'm going to identify the columns or the information that was updated here. So as Jake just mentioned, the RAS model, the FTE need was updated, so it's now reflecting fiscal years 11-12 through 13-14. That's columns A and B and C. The calculated salary is impacted by two things. One is that average salary from the Schedule 7A information, as well as the BLS factor. So the BLS factor is column G, and the calculated salary that relates to the average salary and the BLS factor can be seen in column H. As it relates to the benefits calculation, that information was updated based on the 14-15 Schedule 7A, and you can see the updated information in columns I1, I2, J1, and J2. And that those are the columns that were updated. We did not update the OE&E needed. That will be potentially reviewed later, but that calculation or those amounts per FTE have not changed, as well as the AB 1058. And I also wanted to note that the WAFM will, these numbers are still preliminary, as the RAS FTE need will be updated to reflect the interim complex civil case weight, as well as it will be updated to reflect the AB 1058, updated AB 1058 costs.
So let me pause right there real quickly. So so the things that will change when this, before this goes final, as Colin said, are the complex civil litigation. So that element that was recommended from this group the last time is with the Workload Assessment Advisory Committee, and they're looking at how to incorporate, you know, those complex civil cases at a higher weight and what that does to the model. So that still has to be updated before the final budget. And then, as Colin said, the other one, which – and so that impact is not known. We don't know what that looks like. the Title 4D is likely a very minor adjustment, but that has to be updated. Those two updates will happen. The other one that Colin mentioned on the operating expenses, that number, which you can see on a number of pages, but it's on 79 or 80 of the PDF at the bottom, that operating expense per FTE was set when we built the model, and that has not been updated since 2013. And there's no plan in the current cycle to update that number. So that's just an item that came up through our discussions in the last couple of weeks that we may need to look at as part of the workload assessment, or the workload subcommittee's work on maintaining this model. So we hadn't built anything in to look at, is there inflationary increases on that operating expense in future years. So that hasn't been built in at all. It's the same number it's been for the last 3 years, and there's no plan in the current cycle to update that. So that will take some analysis in order to make that correct. On the work plan for next year is to look at IT expenses and how those might impact that OE&E number. So we may combine those all together as one analysis, but that wouldn't be until next fiscal year. So there won't be anything changing in that number when this goes towards final in June or July. I just wanted to clarify that point.
And one other thing to note as it relates to the calculated WAFM need, looking at the relative changes for individual courts, 47 of the 58, about 81% of the courts had less than a 5% change in either direction as it relates to their relative needs. So it's relatively stable, the changes. There aren't a lot of significant changes outside of that. And then moving on to page 87, we'll walk through the actual allocation amounts based on the updated 2015-16 WAFM need. So on attachment 9I, we display the historical funding as usual, as well as the proportional amount of that historical funding in column B. The share of the total WAFM funding need is updated for 15-16, that's column C. And then we've added a column reflecting the reallocation ratio in column D. This basically reflects for every dollar that's being allocated, how much the court would receive back for any reallocation. So in the instance of the first court, Alameda, the reallocation ratio is 74.4%. So for every dollar of their historical funding that's being reallocated, they would receive 74.4 cents back of that. The first grouping is the reallocation of the 30%, and this is based on the updated WAFM. So the 15% that was allocated last year is reversed, but we'll get to that in a second. So the first column reflects a reallocation based on the 30%. The next group of columns is the new reallocation of the new funding from prior years. So we reverse what was reallocated in prior years, and we reallocate it based on the updated WAFM in 15-16. So this is the new funding from basically 13-14, 14-15 at $146.3 million. And then the subsequent group of columns is the reallocation of $90.6 million. This is just assuming, based on what's in the governor's budget, that we receive $90.6 million in new funding. So this is the reallocation of the historical funding based on receiving $90.6 million in new funding. Then the next group of columns, which are columns N and O, that's the allocation of the new money. So part of it is the one for column N, the $146.3 million. This is basically the allocation of the new funding from prior years based on the updated WAFM. And then column O is the $90.6 million in new funding that's going to be updated based on the updated WAFM. And then the last two columns, P and Q, are the reversal of allocations from 14-15. So based on the 14-15 WAFM, we're reversing the 15% reallocation. We're also reversing the $146.3 million allocation and reallocation. And column R provides you with your total net effect of all those adjustments. And lastly is column S, and this is the funding floor adjustment based on the current assumed allocations for 15-16.
Okay, so to touch on this at a broader level, if you go back to this time last year, you'll find the same layout and spreadsheet. So the way that the Judicial Council staff have walked through this calculation is the same as last year. So you'll see the same calculations. The numbers have obviously changed, but the methodology they use is the same as they went through last year on the budget process. I think we wanted to pause there for any questions about what the model looks like and is doing, if there's any so far. None? Excellent. So, Colin, either you confused everybody completely or everyone
it's possible.
Understand. So, okay. So we wanted to touch on then some questions have come up about, well, how is the model doing? You know, are we seeing the model do what we intended to do? And so Stephen's going to talk a little bit about that on what's called Table 1 on page 92. The materials are 93 if you're in the PDF. And the intent of this chart, which is followed up by a graph, is just to show where courts are currently in 14-15 of their percent of loss and funding need and where it looks like things are headed in 15-16 and beyond as the model completes the reallocations over the next couple of years. So I guess, Stephen, I'll have you just walk through that, and then we can talk about the graph, because the graph may be more – it is a nice visual on a couple of pages. But.
Okay. Good afternoon or noon. It's noontime. Judge Earl wanted to share with the entire committee some information we shared with the Funding Methodology Subcommittee last month, and she thought it would be helpful for the entire committee to have to be briefed on this progress, the impact of implementing WAFM currently, and then what the estimated impacts will be. The numbers don't have – the estimates are just estimates, and this is still based on the 2014-15 WAFM. We wanted to share the same information. We didn't want to update it at this point in time. Also, it wouldn't really have an impact on the graph that you'll see and on this particular chart on pages 92 and 93, attachment 9M. So what we've done is to look at progress by one metric, and that is where are courts now and where are they going to be in terms of their total estimated funding needs. So we looked at their actual and estimated allocation as a percentage of their funding needs based on the 2014-15 WAFM. So you'll see a percentage. And you'll see that in 14-15, all courts, well, except for three courts, they're all under 100%. They're not at their funding level need. So we looked at 14-15. We made some assumptions about 15-16. A key one is that we're going to get $90.6 million in new funding next year. And then we made some assumptions about 16-17 and 17-18 that we'll get $50 million, a somewhat conservative assumption for those two fiscal years. And then estimated what the share of their total funding need would be. In general, you can see your courts numbers and other numbers, and probably the graph will be – the graph is really the information that's contained in attachment 9M. Generally, you'll see that the trend is courts that are – subject to getting an increase in their allocation based on WAFM. And we'll go over this concept of the reallocation ratio. Colin just mentioned it. I'll go over it once more, is that if your reallocation ratio is less than 100%, you lose money, your court gets a reduction for every allocation of $1 based on that. So if it's 90%, for every $1 that's reallocated, you get back 90%, or your court is subject to a 10% reduction of that money. If it's greater than 100%, you get back that amount. So if it's 1.142%, which it is for one court, for every dollar that's reallocated, they get back $1.42. So they gain 42 cents. And so you'll see that the pattern is basically courts that have a reallocation ratio of greater than 100%, they're getting closer. The graph shows that they're getting closer to getting to their funding need. The slope of that curve, the speed of whether or not the extent which they get back to 100% depends on the new funding. Depends on two factors right now, actually. It depends on the amount of reallocation that's being phased in based on WAFM over the five-year period, 10%, 15% this year, 30% next year, 40% after that, and then 50%. And that's where we're at in terms of the council policy. And then any new funding will accelerate the courts getting closer to their total funding need. There are a number of courts that are actually going down. So the other phenomenon is that most courts are going up. Some are going up faster because the reallocation ratio is higher. But there are a number of courts that are going down. They're actually getting further away from their funding need. And the way that the graph works is that some courts are coming down and other courts are going up. And they're meeting at a point at which, at some point in time, all courts will go up. Once we get to a certain point, once we phase in all of reallocation based up to 50% and new funding, then all courts will start going up. The question is when will we reach that point? And we can't say for certain because it depends on the level of new funding that we'll receive and when we receive it. So actually, we can turn to that graph. If you look at 9N, page 94, you'll see that most courts are moving up, and then there are maybe five or six lines are going down. I excluded Alpine and Sierra. They are at 100% because they are subject to the absolute funding floor of $750,000. So they're the only two courts right now that are funded not only 100%, actually a little bit above or quite above what their funding need would suggest. And so that's the graph you see. So they're all moving toward the same place up until 17, 18. Again, the slope of these lines will change depending on the level of new funding. It'll be higher if there's new funding, lower if there's less funding than what we're assuming at this point in time. But most courts are moving up. Let's move to attachment 9-0, and I'll give you a little bit more concrete.
Judge Earl, can I ask a question?
Sure.
So, Stephen, on 9N, mm-hmm. What is the one line that's well above 100%, almost at 110%, and very flat across the top of that graph?
I think that is MODOC. Right. I think that's MODOC. And I did not include the funding floor adjustment in some of these.
Oh, I see. The funding floor adjustment isn't in here.
Right. So they're, I think if you look at the number, they are, yeah, this doesn't include the funding floor adjustment. I think that's why they're not, they're above, I believe.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
On that, Kim, I think if you look at these, there's some that flatten out. They're kind of going up, and they flatten out at 100%.
Yeah.
So I think those are hitting. Mm-hmm. I don't know, Steve, you're saying you don't think you include the funding floor, but that kind of looks like it might be there. And that'd be my guess, and I looked at this before we went into the data. So that's why you see a few of those are behaving a little bit differently.
Oh, the other thing I should mention is, the reason why, and it's also because for some courts, we're including the benefits funding, which is included, it's actually part of the WAF and related allocation. So I think once we make the adjustment, I think they will come back down, I believe. So
okay.
Okay, so let's turn to Table 90, pages 95 and 96. And we'll take what this chart tells us is a number of things that I think that are helpful. One is that, let me just walk you through quickly what the table presents. Column A is something Colin's already gone over. This is each court's historical share of the historical WAFM base. The actual amount. Column B is the 14-15 WAFM need. Statewide, $2.4 million versus the historical $1.4 billion. Column B2 indicates whether or not the historical need was higher than the WAFA need. And at that point, and historically, a couple years ago, that was true for five courts. Their actual allocation, WAFM-related allocation, was higher than what their total funding need indicated by WAFM. But just to note, though, two courts were subject to the funding floor, absolute funding floor, so you should exclude those two, Alpine and Sierra. MODEC is also gets the graduated funding floor. So leaving just two courts, but at this point in time, Siskiyou and Plymouth, they're actually below their funding need level because they've been receiving reductions over the past 2 years. So they're part of the courts that are actually going, they were fully funded, now they're going down below, and they're not going to go back up until we get a sufficient amount of funding that negates their reallocation reduction back up to a positive number. Column C indicates their share of historical, of A, basically what their number is in A divided by the total in A. D is a total in B divided by the court's number divided by the statewide total. And so E gets you the reallocation ratio. So E is simply D, column D divided by E. And right now you'll see that the two courts that get the absolute funding floor have the smallest reallocation ratio, about 37%. So for every $1 that's reallocated, they only get back 37 cents. They lose 63 cents. The court, based on the 14-15 WAFM that has the highest reallocation ratio, is Kern at 142%. So for every $1 they give up, they actually get back $1.42. They gain 42 cents.
Not to confuse it too much, but where Stephen's saying those two, they're at 37%. Because they're at the funding floor, that actually gets put back in again when the floor gets applied. So it's out and then a back in.
So there are 35 courts whose reallocation ratio is less than 100%, and that stayed the same using the 15-16 updated WAFM, although two courts switched places. One became over 100% in switch, another went with vice versa. So that was interesting. They were always on the edge, so it doesn't really make that much of a difference in terms of the reallocation. They were always close to about 100%, but they flipped. So what's interesting is if you look at columns F, G, and H, what that indicates is what the cumulative adjustments based on WAFM and excludes any of the funding floor adjustment, the courts that are shaded are those courts that will have a cumulative negative adjustment. And so you see that actually it's a minority, and this doesn't include the funding floor adjustments for Alpine and Sierra. So you can see that most courts have in 15-16 are estimated to have a positive cumulative funding adjustment. Now, it's still painful because for those courts that have a negative, it's definitely painful because, again, most of these courts are still they're moving away from their funding need. The way that the math works in terms of the level of new funding that's being provided and the level of reallocation that's being phased in. But still, it's fairly minimal compared to the 58 courts. And even those courts that do gain that have a positive all the way throughout the 3 years from 15-16 out to 17-18, it's not necessarily good news for them because they may have cost increases that are over and above the positive adjustments that they're getting. But overall, that's what we expected under WAFM. Those courts that have a reallocation ratio that's above 100%, they're moving. They're progressing. They're getting closer to what their funding level need is. Those courts are under. Some courts are making some progress. Most courts are moving closer, but not at a very high rate. And there's some courts that are absolutely going down, and it's going to depend on, again, when we get enough money to move all courts up to a positive number moving towards their funding need.
Okay, so one last piece on the graph itself back on page 94, 95 in the PDF. You know, this goes out to 17-18, which is as far as we've defined any reallocation of historical money, and that's why you see whatever the bottom line there is. I'm going to guess it's Kern, but the sort of bluish line is that everyone's sort of moving towards whatever the current funding percent is. They're moving there, and then it sort of stops at that point. So if we drew this line out, unless there's new money, that gap would stay. So whatever the sort of orangish, pinkish line is towards before the line, so kind of crazy. That gap, which is about, 13%-ish, would remain a relative funding unless there's new money that comes in, because we've only said we're going to reallocate 50% of historical funding. So everyone's moving towards in line and more towards a point, but we only define that up until 17-18. So that difference won't change unless there's new funding coming in that would continue to kind of bring those lines together.
Sean?
On the graph, there's also a light blue line that just kind of has a clear trajectory up. The others kind of gradually go up. Is that an anomaly, or is that?
I don't know if I can explain that. I think I forgot who it was, but I don't know the reason for it. But yes, there is one court that does that. It's a smaller court.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions, thoughts? Jake or Colin or Stephen, did you have anything else to add?
Well, the only thing I would add is that when you're looking at the main spreadsheet that runs through the reallocation, which was where we were here, the next item talks about on the agenda, which may be after lunch, but talks about the revenue shortfall. And so this is assuming allocating all $90.6 million that is assumed to come through the budget process, assuming it holds, without dealing with whatever that revenue shortfall looks like. So the next item there's a decision that we may need to make about that. So the only caution I would put out there is the numbers that you see here, this walks you to the calculation. The item we have later may refine that number a little bit so everyone's looking at what their allocation might be. So I'd sort of hold, if you're out there working on your spreadsheets real quickly, and wait till we address the next item because that number might look a little different.
Yeah, I just wanted to add one thing. We provided attachments 9P and 9Q for you or your staff are interested in understanding what our assumptions are and want to replicate the graphs or any of the computations in the other tables. So I won't be walking through this. But if your staff have any questions, they can feel free to call me.
Judge Good?
I'd just like to observe, excuse me, that while this is accomplishing the objective of making the courts more equal in their funding, anybody who is using this as an advocacy tool ought to point out that we're being made more equal at barely more than 80% of our need. And it ranges from two-thirds of our need to 80% of our need, and we're all being made more equal at an impoverished level. And that's an important point that this graph makes, but we've got to be sure we point that out.
Thank you. Any other thoughts? All right. Thank you. We are going to take a break at this point, and we will be back online at 1 o'clock. 1 o'clock.